You're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads podcast.
So hello and welcome along to another episode of the Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. For any first time listeners out there, this podcast is where we have a chat to a special guest from the rugby world to talk about the sport we all love. But also we combine that with the sole reason why we do this podcast, which is to continue talking about and raising awareness for mental health. And for everyone who's been listening to our podcast and been interacting with the podcast so far, we've been really humbled by some of the responses and the feedback we've had. So hopefully by doing this podcast, we are helping to achieve the goal which Looseheads have set out to do. And to pull all of this together are, of course, the three founders of Looseheads, which are Mark Shotton, Rob Shotton and Dave Nichols. So guys, welcome along. And for this episode, you are Movemberless. As we enter December, the moustaches are gone. But Rob, it seemed like a really successful campaign which you guys were involved with.
Yeah, it was really good, really good. I'm glad that we've got rid of the horrible look. I won't be walking, well, I can walk past parks now, which is nice. A lot of awareness raised. We did a Movember video campaign as well, so go and check that out on Instagram. A lot of our ambassadors talking quite openly about their own struggles or just talking openly and opening up the conversation, really. So, yeah, it was a really good campaign.
Yeah, Mark, moustache gone, new haircut, change man.
New haircut, moustache gone, 1970s porn star image thrown away, back at the gym, loving it.
Brilliant. And obviously the Looseheads as well, Rob, have been making waves, no more so than this week. I know you were mentioned quite a bit on the Good, the Bad and the Rugby podcast with Alex Payne, James Haskell, as well as Mike Tindall. So that must be really pleasing that you guys have been talked about on one of the leading podcasts, rugby podcasts in the country.
Yeah, we've had a couple of conversations with them recently, just about sort of pushing, you know, talking about mental health a bit more in the game we love. So it's great to sort of get the recognition for what we're doing. And yeah, just like I said before, opening up the conversation a bit more.
Yeah, and do check the guys out at looseheads.co.uk if you haven't already. And do follow them on social media, because what they've been up to recently and over the course of the time I've known about Looseheads is frankly unbelievable. And rarely do you see the guys have a quiet day. And it's been fantastic to work alongside the Looseheads team so far. And one of the guests who has recently appeared on the Good, the Bad and the Rugby podcast joins us today on the Loosehead podcast. I think it's probably right to say that he's podcast royalty over the last sort of a few weeks or so with his own podcast, which he's launched the last couple of months. So we're delighted to say that Benjamin Kaiser joins us on the podcast. So Benjamin, thank you so much for giving us your time to chat to us on the Looseheads podcast today. You mentioned before we press record, it has been a busy week for you, so we really appreciate you giving up your time.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me. So obviously what I said to you a couple of minutes ago, the recent actuality of the combination of England and France being the final everybody wanted for World Nations Cup, and I'm doing some media and some commentary work, and the passing, the devastating news of losing Christophe Dominici way too young, is the perfect combo to basically me to be invited everywhere to chat. So like I said to you guys, I was happy to do it because I think it's a very, very important time. Awareness is being raised, it's acknowledged as a problem. We are taking the brutal reality of the consequences that it can generate in the face. You guys probably every single day, the general public and myself, extremely right in the mouth with Christophe Dominici going. And now the chat is just to say, what's the next steps? How are we going to finally take this into a general plan of action? For that, you need everybody's financial power, strategic decisions, willpower to be in place. I think that's the case now. And it's just a matter of finding the other place. But I mean, Looseheads, I think, has been doing a terrific job at finding the right angle. Professional rugby players in particular, there's such physical, men's orientated, live or die, invincible sort of almost like knighthood sort of sport fits perfectly by leading by example, by saying nobody's too big, nobody's too strong, nobody's unbreakable. We all have stuff that we need to deal with. Now it's a matter of actually strapping a pair on and showing our courage by opening up rather than closing down and not sharing anything. So I think your angle is terrific. And I'm actually the one who reached out to you because on an academic level, I'm back studying business at Oxford and we're doing a current entrepreneurial project at the moment, which is based around mental health. So everything interlinks, right? And a good chat is always a good chat. And that's what I'm trying to multiply at the moment. And so that's why I'm particularly delighted to speak to you guys today.
Yeah, brilliant, Benjamin. And I mean, from my personal point of view, in terms of talking about mental health and realizing the significance of it, and my brother won't mind me saying this, that my brother's gone through struggles over sort of the last couple of years or so, and it really hit home to me that the importance of raising awareness. And I think maybe for some, when it is a little bit closer to home, people do actually stand up, take notice and say, well, something needs to be done now. And I think what you've just said there encapsulates firstly what the Loose Heads team do, but what people in society are hopefully moving towards.
Absolutely. And like you mentioned your brother, so obviously it hits like your heart with a spear. But we all have something, we all have someone. And the degree of catastrophic consequences sometimes does not go to the extent of Domi. That doesn't mean that it shouldn't be addressed. That's what I'm trying to say around rugby. For one, we need to stop this thing of, how you doing, mate? Yeah, I'm okay, and finishing there. That's a men's thing that we need to drive through, swim through, we need to basically, you know, get our sonar, our radar more switched on to learning how to navigate to those blunt conversations and going deeper. If we're really mates, if we're talking about brotherhood, I mean, rugby, we're taught day in, day out to go deeper than just that. We're taught day in, day out to go full on 150% into extreme emotions, extreme brotherhood, extreme friendship, ready to go through walls together. But then whenever we don't want to talk about emotions, when it could show a tiny bit of weakness, then everybody closes off and you don't say anything. That's not manhood. That's not strapping a pair. That's not showing your braveness to me, anyhow. And that's what gradually we're getting rid of. It was the same idea with concussion. You couldn't show weakness. You couldn't show that you want to take care of your body. You couldn't show you need to protect yourself a little bit. And it's the same sort of idea. So this culture and this idea and those ethics they take a long, long time to be moved, to be pushed, and to be transformed. But just saying the connotation around mental health is obviously very hard to swallow for some people. And it's also a matter of saying that having mental health issues doesn't mean that you're going to grab a rifle and go, you know, shoot people in school. It just means that you're dealing with stuff, and everybody deals with stuff all the time. And we're all hit by different things, and it hits home in rugby because very young in your career, you need to have what we call in French the little death, the la petite mort, when you finish your rugby career. And that's a massive transition. But I mean, so a teenager whose parents split a divorce, you know, when they're 16, can have the same consequence. Veterans doing this, changing, getting sacked from your job for some whatever reason, even if you're incredible, but because the economical consequences of a poor, you know, poor decision making led to that. All these are very traumatic circumstances that actually rugby helps to solve most of the time, because rugby is the clubhouse, the sense of community. Being alone is basically the beginning of disaster. So we shouldn't be alone to deal with the stuff that we've got in the heads. And more importantly, we should learn some tools to actually assess them, help others, and help yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Benjamin. And you talk about kind of, you know, when you said there, you might be at the top of your game with work. And in terms of rugby, that might be, you know, you would have played for 10 to 15 years. And then one day you decide to sort of hang up the boots or injury gets in the way. And that's what you mean there, isn't it? When you talk about, you can relate to rugby with all of this, because players will eventually come to the end of their career. It's such a dangerous sport, isn't it? It could be over in an instant, and people just have to think about those consequences and make sure that if people do step out of the game, they are not alone, because it is a difficult time for any player.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's for any player, for any person, it's complicated. The main complicated side of mental health issues is the fact that we're all unique. We all have a brain that's ours. Some of us, especially in rugby, have got half a brain, you know, but we'll just deal with it. But we are all so different, which means that none of them have got exactly the same pathology. So none of us have got the same way of healing, and none of us have had the same way of expressing things. So it is particularly complicated. That's why I don't blame the doctors. It's like same thing for the consequences of concussion. Everybody's so happy about thinking, oh, I found this one protein. It will prove to solve the thing. Well, I can tell you, because my former club in Clermont were absolutely fantastic to try to show that they were taking a step in the right direction. They funded some research and all that. But everybody just wants one easy answer. Is he good or is he bad? Well, the gray zone is the whole life of mental health and concussion conclusion, even though I don't really like to speak about them in the same way. But I'm just saying, I'll spit it out because it's important. But in our EP project, the title is basically make the invisible visible. Because it is so hard to assess and so hard to cure, because nobody can really understand what it is. So I just think that we have to accept and be comfortable with the fact that a perfect solution will never be found, whether it's concussions, CTE, or mental health problem. A perfect solution won't. But if we can, and nobody can say, I will find a way of healing 100% of the patients. That's not possible. It will never happen. Because it depends. It depends on so many patterns, on willpower from the individual. Also, it depends on so many things. But let's try to give ourselves the best possible chance of doing so. Basically, so multiply the number of initiatives and tools and strategies and whatever we can consider to try to get as close as we can to 100%. It will never be, but we'll try. So. Like you said, it can impact anyone, anywhere, all the time, but that's the nature of the beast. And that's why it's so complicated. And that's why that's why it can't be only just the doctors taking care of it. Everybody needs to step in. Everybody needs to realize that it needs to be a global thing.
Tell you what, if ever anyone doubted that the rugby, the brain of the rugby forward is 20 times bigger than the rugby back, which I subscribe to, then that last 10 minutes proves it. The brains are in the pack.
Absolutely. The brains and most of the balls as well.
And just sticking on sort of the topic of mental health, Benjamin, in terms of the end of your career, I know you had a couple of serious injuries with your neck, and it was a decision which you had to take for a health reason. And I know you probably would have looked to carry on playing and maybe get another year or two, but did you sort of have that support of your family around you? Because it would have been such a difficult time to finish a really glittering career for yourself.
Yeah, no, so I was, to be honest, it was an easier, much easier decision to take at 35 than at 25. I think when you're young, it must be just impossible. I did what I had to do. I obviously, you know, the cupboard full of trophies, if you can just add a sneaky one at the end, you're super happy, you know? It's just one is one, and obviously it's never enough, and we're hungry for more. But it was a time for me to press pause and to realize that, I think it really struck home when I had this one conversation with a neurosurgeon. So without getting into the detail, it basically is my neck is gone. And I already had an operation on two levels. So it's as if I had two operations after long, long lasting troubles where I lost a strength in my arm. So it already wasn't good at all. I knew it was an ongoing thing. At some point, somehow, the curtain was going to close on it, because I think for me, the brain and the neck is where you can't joke around. I can live with a busted knee. I can limp for a few years. I can have a busted hip. You know, I've got dodgy fingers and stuff. That's all right. But the neck and the brain, I just think is where that, for me personally, I draw the line. And so basically, when I had this conversation with my neurosurgeon, who's been following me in Clermont for the last 10 years and really knows my case inside out, and he's like, listen, best case scenario, I don't need an op, but in 15 years time, the degeneration of the impact of chronic degeneration of what I've got on the moelle épinière, what's in the middle, not the bone marrow, but you know, what's in the middle of the canal, can basically impact my nervous system, then my fingers might start to go. I think I'm 35. In 15 years, I'll be 50. I've got two young girls. They're 6 and 3. In 15 years, I want to be playing tennis with them. What are you talking about? I mean, this is sport. This is a passion. This is what I adore rugby. Don't get me wrong. I adore the brotherhood. I mean, my best memories are the back of a bus when I was 14 and when I was 35 after a win. It's the 5 minutes before a game. It's the 5 minutes after a big win. Of course. But I never, ever, ever forgot. And I got very well paid for it, even... okay, but I never forgot it was a game, it was a passion, it was a sport. I did that for fun, you know. So when the doctor said that, Unofficially, I'll tell you that I thought about it for a long, long time. Unofficially, I'll tell you the reality is when he told me that it was game over, because I just didn't want to joke around. But I was, you always need to be comfort. How do you say that? You need somebody to back up your decision, you know, to make it a good one. And so my inner circle was my wife, who desperately wanted me to get out of rugby for my body was getting really, really seriously hit. And my dad, who also was like that. So it was a pretty easy decision. I also could sat in front of a head coach, Frank Azema, who I've known for a long time. We had a pretty deep bond. And he, when I told him, he almost told me, oh, you almost, how does it make me a relief? You know, you're almost causing me to relax, because the last thing I wanted is to take the responsibility of putting on your field and after putting your life in jeopardy, if you know what I mean. So in the end, it was an easy decision. Wasn't planned, but, you know, life happens. But again, at 35, I think it was relatively easy to do compared to, unfortunately, what others have to make.
Benjamin, you spoke on the good about the rugby, and you talked about sort of always being busy since you've retired and not having time for reflection. And I think Haskell mentioned, he sort of talks about living like a shark, where if a shark stops, it'll die. If a shark stops swimming, it'll die. So his way of dealing with things is just to keep going in life. There's that whole phrase about, you know, pressing pause but not pressing stop. Just how important is it in life to sort of take a breather every now and again and press that pause button?
Well, I'm not a good example, but I think you're spot on right. It is very, very important. And it's also that it was really funny, because speaking of all those conversations, you think it's something new, but every time I speak to guys, we basically say the same thing. And I'm thinking, do we never chat? Do we never share? Do we never actually, like Mike Tindall is a rugby legend. Okay. And then you guys know him a lot better than I do, but still. And I was blown away when the few things that he said on Monday were precisely the way that I felt. So I back myself. Huh? I've always had businesses on the side. I know I can do okay in the media. I know the world is a big place and I really want to do a lot of things. But still, and this is what Mike said, once you've excelled at something, it's very, very complicated to feel legitimate in anything else. Because obviously that was the thing that I did the best. At the moment, it's the thing that I did the best, was to be a rugby player in my professionally, if you know what I mean. So anything else that you do, you're like, ooh, am I really that good? Am I really? And you doubt a lot on your potential of actually doing anything else. And I doubted of everybody's like, oh, you know, you learn so much with professional sport. And I was like, I'm not so sure. And actually what Oxford taught me is that brilliant brains around me, much, much smarter people than me around the room, but none of them had to deal with 80,000 people looking at you and you throwing a line out 5 meters out. None of them had to lose 5 European finals and still get back up and keep on going. You know, all those things, is true that life just makes you stronger and better. And to realize it, exactly like you said, sometimes you just need either to do it yourself or to have a bit of help to press pause and to assess. To assess doesn't mean picking up all your flaws. It also sometimes giving you a tap on the back. You're like, yeah, I've got some skills. I've got some good stuff. I did some cool things, you know. I know that I did some cool things, but sometimes you don't realize what. It's not just the line of the title, but maybe you'll realize that you actually helped a young kid who did really well. And that's something that I always try to do, give back and all that. So I think you're dead right. It's important to assess. It's important to take time to reflect, to think on yourself. But what James said about the shark mentality of never stopping is also, which links to Domi, the biggest champions in rugby or in rugby in professional sport in general, in sport in general, are driven, are passionate. I've got this extreme sense of dedication and perfectionism. You want everything to be perfect. You know, you're never happy with anything else, and you expect a lot from others, so you can be a bit tough and all that. But that's precisely what gets you to the top, but it's also what drives you to the ground. So if you don't take time, like you said, to assess, to realize, and then to keep on going, it can be tricky. So yes, it is definitely something that I'm working on.
You mentioned about how the decision to retire was a lot easier being 35 compared to 25. Do you think rugby in general does kind of enough to support players for looking at a future outside of rugby? knowing that it could all be over in an instant?
So that's a very tricky question, but it's a very central question to the sustainability of what we all love in rugby, which is which are those values, the brotherhoods, just the general people can express themselves in the best way, be the best version of yourself thanks to rugby, through rugby, within rugby. And it all goes down to player motivation also. I've been, like I said to you, I'm an entrepreneur. I've got loads of businesses on the side and stuff. And all the guys are like, oh, but how you doing and stuff? The more I took on after outside rugby, the better I was on the pitch. I swear to you. And it's something that I am desperate to get across, especially in France, the economical risk because of the investments in top 14 are just ginormous. And so the pandemic has hit us in the mouth by saying this system is not sustainable. There's too much risk, too much distance of that. And so basically the players get paid so much cash that they're not actually, well, long story short, I think we should go back to promoting a little bit less money, but with other ways of supporting players. For instance, pluriactivity, multi-activity. I think that was the best thing that happened in rugby, when you get paid serious money, you're well looked after, but never enough to only do that in your life. That is the best tool we've got. To force guys to keep on studying a little bit. Force guys to have an interest in within the club. In Clermont, for instance, for 10 years there was 550 sponsors. That's just there was five big sponsors like Michelin, Renault, you know, all those guys. And then there's 550 small sponsors. Whether it's a tiny, from $2,000 a year to $100,000 a year, whatever they give. These guys are mental about rugby. When you walk into a room, you have every single trade, pretty much the world, who's looking at you. So if you have the interest and the belief to actually go out there and do something, the possibilities are endless. But I don't think there's ever been a player who sat there and said, listen, can you just give me you want to pay me 10, pay me 8, but every Monday I'm not here. I'll just come in for an hour or two, whatever, and then I'm not here. And then you can go and learn a trade. You can go keep on studying. You can do whatever. And these are things I know for a fact that are starting to come back. And I think that's the best thing that can happen in rugby. Because you will see the guys, they will not move for 500 quid more a month. I'm going to stay where I am, because in 10 years down the line, just like you said, if something happens, then I've got I've got another side job, or I'm actually learning another trade. You know, I'm putting something else to me. So I really do think the future of rugby is in that not enough is done. Rugby needs to restructure to actually create a real economy, not this fake economy where millionaires will just pull out a check at the end of the year. Stade Français have lost 17 million in the last 3 years consecutively. But the owner of Stade Français is worth 4.2 billion bucks. I mean, without being rude, he wipes his ass with a rugby club every morning. It's 4.2 billion. You know, so he can afford to lose all that money. He doesn't need to create an economy, but not all clubs are like that. Clermont, whether you like it or not, everybody says, oh, Michelin. Yeah, Michelin is a sponsor like all others. 1 year, we had a shit year. The president did not take a holiday because he needed to find $500,000 to actually close the budget. Otherwise, we were screwed. Toulouse, all of that also. And I'm sure in England, you have the same examples. What comes in, comes out, and it needs to balance. But when you create this, And then, so players should be put in the middle. And that's why probably the only good thing of the pandemic on the economy of rugby is that players, for the first time, were sat down and are like, you need to take a pay cut 25%. Otherwise, we're all going bust. This is not good news. Don't get me wrong. But I think it's healthy. It just means people thought it was falling from the sky. And you'll see that guys now will sign longer contracts, but for less money, just for the security. And actually, and they will look for something else than just the valuation of their worth through money. And I think that's very, very healthy. So not enough is done, definitely, but not enough player motivation exists also. That's what I'm trying to say.
I guess sort of salary cap scandal aside, do you think Sarri's maybe were onto something with the model?
100%. 100%. Like spot on, which is, I don't know the exact ins and outs of the salary cap thing. Yeah? So let's be careful. And I jealous these guys massively because they beat me in finals more than once. I wanted those three Champions Cup. I've been running after it my whole life and I never even touched at it. Okay. And they won it three times and they had a beast of a team. But I always say to the boys, so in 2017, we lose to them in Murrayfield, the Champions Cup final, but we end up winning top 14. If you compare the starting 15 of Clermont. I was trying to, but they cheated, salary cap, blah, blah, blah. And I always told everyone, like, sit down with me 2 seconds, get your head out of your ass a little bit, stop reading the press, show me the two lineups, show me who you would take from Saracens to play for us. Show me the guys that actually, because they're paid so much and blah, 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 are making a difference. Of course, they have some incredible players. I would definitely take the Vunipola brothers. I'd take Itoje, Farrell. Of course. In the backs, or even some in the front, I would definitely not change the 23. And in the end, we picked basically, it's about 6 guys that you would pick from them to come to us. What's a 23-man sport, or even 35-man sport with the full squad? So it's not because of that that they won. The reason why they won is because they were on track of putting added value and competitive advantage on a different aspect of rugby. Pride of the jersey, club, how do you say that? Yeah, pride of being part of the club, and just sense of belongingness, and how you say that? You know, like, fierté d'appartenance. You know, and one of the examples I've got is that the last Challenge Cup game, quarterfinal, Bristol-Bordeaux, that's what I said to the boys the other day. I saw Ben Earl still with the Bristol jersey on, who gets man of the match, and he's like, what does it feel to be a Bristol Bears? Oh, no, I'm just here on loan. Huh? And by the way, we're playing tomorrow Leinster, and I hope that we win. He's talking about Saracens. The guy's wearing a Bristol jersey. And I'm thinking, bloody hell, if I can be in a team with 50% of the, well, of the where the guys love the jersey and the club, 50% of that, there's no chance that everybody will touch me because we have the quality to do it. And on top of that, like I said to you, those Dr. Wild, $4.2 billion. He's obviously, I don't think, very healthy for rugby, but if they have one asset, they didn't create this money and fall for the sky. They are business geniuses. So let's take them for what they are. In France, or even in England, Bruce Gregg, Nigel Ray, whatever. And that's what Nigel Ray was doing. He's obviously a very good businessman. He obviously knows his stuff, right? So I think it's a blessing that he wanted to co-invest with some players. That is the best thing that can happen with rugby. Take Bruce Gregg, let's say Sam Underhill gets paid 10. Well, no, I will pay him 7, but he will co-invest with Bruce Gregg for 30 something else. Blah, blah, blah. Please, that's the best thing that can happen. That's the best support system that we can create in this economy of rugby. Because yeah, there's some serious stuff. And you learn so much in entrepreneurship. And I think sport does teach you. I think professional sportsmen do fit really well the entrepreneur role because they're driven, they can create passion, they're charismatic, they're not afraid of failure, you know, so there's a lot of fit to it. So I think you got it spot on. When I saw all those things, yes, if they cheated by saying, we pay you 10, but actually they pay him in total, they pay him 300 because there's this that they pay for and that they pay for, that's cheating, okay. But the co-investments, I thought, was a very, very good thing. And all those guys like Nigel Ray, like Bruce Gregg and stuff, I know they do it because they have a genuine, or Nigel Ray at least, he had a genuine will for players to be happy and to relax about the future in their future. And I think that was one great way of doing it.
G'day guys, it's Brad Shields here. I'm a Looseheads ambassador. You're listening to a Looseheads podcast. Mental health is just as important as physical health.
And so let's just move on to sort of your playing career, if you don't mind, Benjamin. You mentioned Clermont there, where you spent a very large chunk of your career, but you were obviously born and raised in Paris. Stade Français was your club. And was that always sort of a goal for you growing up, that was a club you were definitely going to play for, whatever that may be in your career?
Oh, yeah. No. I started rugby very late, so I didn't know much about... I played every single sport that possibly can be imagined. I was even very good at ping pong, that's to tell you. So I tried a bit of everything. But funnily enough, my first training that my dad insisted to bring me to was rugby. And I actually started rugby in Hong Kong. So my dad was a strategy consultant. We traveled a lot in the world. That's why I speak English, because we lived in the States when I was very young. So I always knew how to speak English. And in Hong Kong, rugby is a religion. And my PE coach was the number 8 and captain of the Hong Kong team, Stuart Cron, big solid dude. And he was also a rugby coach, obviously, in Hong Kong. And so he took me there one day, absolutely loved it, and then didn't play for 2-3 years because the other cities that we went to in Shanghai and Beijing didn't have any rugby. And then I went back to Paris. At the time, I played basketball. And a former schoolmate of mine from Hong Kong actually lived not far from me in Paris. He's like, what do you do now? Well, I play basketball. Okay, do you want to try rugby again? So yeah, why not? I'll give it a try. Where do you play? He's like, in Stade Français. I didn't have a clue. And they were French champion that season. Stade Français is a crazy story. They were really down like sixth division or something, and then gradually came back up. Max Guazzini, Bernard Laporte came when they were in third, fourth division. Just an incredible thing. Max created it. That's a whole different chapter. You need another podcast to speak about that. But it's a crazy good story, to be fair. And so I rocked up there in October. You know how when you just rock up, you know, can I have a go, boys? And then I was already quite big and stuff. And then never left. Fell in love with it. Loved it. All my mates from school, I started erasing the numbers from my phone, and I just filled it up with the rugby boys. It just clicked better. There was a better sense of value. Assessing courage, what I really like. Yeah, at school, it was more, you know, who would get in a fight, who would smoke weed behind a tree, and all that stuff. And most of the fighting were, I mean, you know, they would make a lot of noise and there was like one slap at the end. At least that was in my high school. I'm not saying it's everywhere like that. And at rugby, if you were the tiniest guy on the pitch, but you didn't have a put tackle, but if you had the balls to throw yourself in the knees of the biggest dude in the opposition, that was a big statement, you know, so that's what I liked. So Stade Français was never the one, but the Stade Français professional team was the first one I always wanted to play for. I had posters of Dominici and Peter De Villiers and Sylvain Marconnet in my bathroom and stuff. And that's why it was so precious for me to become one of the first from the academy to go all the way to the first team and then to the French team.
You mentioned kind of Dominici there. Benjamin, and I know I think you were sort of starting out when he was coming to the end of his time at Stade Français, if that's correct, and you talked about him before, obviously, when we're talking about the Loosehead stuff, but could you just give us kind of a tribute to the man? You used the word legend on your podcast earlier this week. It's a term in rugby, I think we've talked about it a lot, that does get banded around, but for this player in particular, I think the word legend perfectly suits him.
Oh yeah, nice. He was an absolute legend. If legend is overused, then take that one back and just say that, I don't know what you guys have in England, but in France, we've got the Panthéon in Paris, which is an old church. And if you're buried under there, is when you've done something extraordinary. So like the Molière, the former kings and this and that will be in there. And that was like through history. So now if somebody gets buried there, that means I'm pretty sure like General de Gaulle, you know, like sort of saved France in the Second World War, you know, it's that type of thing. And for me, he would be in the Pantheon of rugby by a mile. He's like, he was charismatic, incredibly brave, huge heart. Just somebody who shines, you know, he just had something about him. And he did help me. He inspired me. Like I said, we weren't friends because he was too old, too good, too incredibly popular already. And I was just the 18-year-old chubby white fella who rocked up in the first team, you know. I would do anything he asked me to. He asked me to dive to, you know, to tackle a bin. I would tackle a bin. He asked me to go and get beers in a bar. I would go get beers. But he never did. They never took the piss. But he would never motivate me, but he would always be there to help me when he saw that my nerves or my mind was playing a little bit. I always said there's a big thing when you're a hooker is the throwing. So I was really good at scrummaging. I was really good at playing. I was actually a very good thrower, but getting into the French team, that extra stress really paralyzed me when I came off the bench. Starting, I was fine because you just think about something else and you play. But coming off the bench, like the worst thing you could do to me is come off the bench, go straight to lineup. Oh my word. Like my world would collapse, you know? And my first ever game, they call a lineup at the back. It's like we're winning by 40 points in Béziers. You know, the coach is like, kid, you cannot cock this one up. Enjoy. You know, he's like, enjoy. You got 20 minutes for your first game. There was zero pressure. And I come in and I come on and the first lineup, I hit it in the back of the Loosehead's head. She was like completely shit. I was like this. And for some whatever reason, I didn't understand. And my timing was off. So I started throwing. Then you try to stop in the middle. And I just ended up throwing something small in the face of the Loosehead. Everybody's looking at me like, what have you done? And I'm there. I'm purple. And I want to like dig a hole, you know, and go hide somewhere. Then there's another scrum. The first scrum, I get popped. And then I try to tackle a dude by flying out the line, you know, to like whack somebody. I just wanted to hit somebody hard, but he ends up stepping me last minute and I miss him. I was a really good ball carrier for my age. That's what they wanted me to do. The first ball that I get bounces off my chest. It is a nightmare. And so, and he really helped me. And he was the type of guy who's like, listen, just sit next to me, stick with me, you'll be fine. You know, stay behind me, I'll protect you. You know, that type of thing. And he was much smaller than me, but I felt protected. So, a legend who what you guys saw on the pitch, he had the same light off the pitch and the same importance for everyone. He was the little kid at the back of the bus who would make the most noise, but he would walk into a room, because that was me, I would just sit and listen because he was just incredible.
Yeah, and I saw you mention, Benjamin, this week, quite a lovely story about, I think you were on a night out with the team and Christoph decided to ditch a girl behind and make you the passenger. And he also sorted out a boot deal for you as well, if that's right.
Yeah. That was the type of guy that he was. I didn't have any boots. He called Nike. I had a contract the next day. I tried to say thank you. He's like, never again. He didn't want to speak about it. Like, you know, yeah. So he just gave everything. He didn't want anything back. And coming out from a nightclub, I remember him coming into with his very beautiful lady into his car, and he saw me walking around, and I didn't have a lot, you know, he didn't want me to pay for a taxi and stuff. He just went, all right, get out. And I jumped in and he drove me home. Legend. You know, I would have not done it. I'm telling you, not at the time, especially not 18. but no, he's just a lovely dude. On the side note, he used to piss off the Ford so much because he was on their faces all the time that at least once a year there was a punishment. And I remember one punishment, because we were in camp. They put some sleeping tablets in his dinner, and then he was sort of dozing off in his room and stuff. And they just walked in, tied his hands, feet, whatever, put him in a van, and they chucked him in the village where we were having camp. And they chucked him bollocks naked in the middle of the village, and just left him there. So the guy's like dozing off naked and stuff, and somebody's there walked in and was like, oh. It's Dominici. And instead of putting a coat on him and stuff, took a picture. He went, kink. It was just unreal. And he didn't take offense. And then he was like, right, I'm going to piss you off even more. That was his attitude. He was like, nothing. He was scared of nothing. Nothing.
Brilliant story. Brilliant story, Benjamin. And just in terms of moving away from France and into your career with England, I know the move to Leicester is such a fantastic story behind it. I'm sure you told it a lot of times, but it seems like transfers, rugby transfers nowadays may not happen the way they happen to you moving to Leicester.
It is quite comical of how quick and easy it went. But basically, I started in 2004, and then by 2007, I was doing really well and stuff, but Dimitri Zarzewski signed the club, and Dimitri Zarzewski and I have got 1 year difference. So age groups, we were already in competition. Under 21s, we were in competition. With the French team, we were in competition, and then he signs in Stade. I'm like, bloody hell. You know, we were constantly on each other's toes. There was mutual respect, but we were never mates. And I'm about to re-sign in Stade because, like I said to you, I was the only boy from the academy to come through. So the president, Max, really had a soft spot for me, and he sort of put me in all the emotions, you can't leave, this is your club, this is your home, you know, just put it in my mind that I would never ever leave. And I'm about to resign, even though it wasn't a great idea. And Augustin Pichot is sitting next to me, and he was another guy who was very good to me, a great mentor, and I was really close to, very close to Domi, very similar personalities. And at the time, he was sort of acting agent for Juan Hernandez, who was arguably the best player in the world in 2007. And I'm just chatting to him, and he's like, oh yeah, so what are you doing? Oh, I'm about to resign his tie. Are you sure? He's like, what about Leicester? Oh, I don't know. I don't have any contacts with Leicester. Oh, hang on a second. He takes his phone out. Simon Cohen, who was director of rugby at Leicester Tigers, who then I got to know for a couple of years. And he's like, what about Ben Kayser? And you know how you can see the three little dots saying typing? You know, the ones under in the text? And then he said, very interesting. Let's talk about it. Okay, I didn't even know they knew me. And so I get a phone call from Richard Cockerill the next day or the following Monday or something. And he's telling me he knew my whole story. He knew everything about me and all that. I don't know how they properly did their homework. So that's one thing that I really liked. That they wanted me, not just another French hooker, if you know what I mean. And then we had to stop talking because 2 weeks later, it just got announced that we actually qualified for champions for the Heineken Cup quarterfinal at the time. And we were playing in Leicester over there. And I've never been, didn't really know much, but 2007, remember, that's Martin Corey, it was Pat Howard and Richard Cockerill. That season, they did three finals. They were killing everyone. And we play that quarter final there. It's the game where Juan Hernandez smashes Alessandro Tuilagi 5 meters out. You know, that huge tackle, he's about to go score. Nobody ever saw my Alessandro Tuilagi being bumped off like that. And the sun was out. It was an incredibly good game. And I fell in love with Belford Road. I was like, bloody hell, that's a good stadium. I loved it. Like, I came out of the changing rooms, you know, where the crowd are standing up. I love that. I thought, I'm a gladiator. Like, I thought I could, you know, rule the world. And I played really well that game. The sun was out, so I got tricked. I thought it was always sunny in Leicester, which is definitely not the case. And then by that time, I was sold. Yeah, I couldn't wait to go. I went to visit the following week. Gus Pichot got me some train tickets. We actually went to visit together because he was still speaking to Juan. And then the training facilities were extraordinary for the time. They were really two steps ahead. So I thought I was signing in the NFL, and then I signed, and it was the best decision in my rugby career. To be honest, I think I should have stayed at least one more year, but stupid decisions. I took it as a challenge because Dimitri said I couldn't come back to my club. I was like, wow, nobody's telling me what I can or can't do in my club. So I came back. I wanted to be in Paris to be closer to my granddad, who wasn't doing great and stuff like that, you know. But Leicester was a tremendous place. I saw in your questions you were talking about the sort of that culture of Leicester. So if you want, I can just keep on going with that. But it was extraordinary. I rocked up in a place that really knew who they were, where they wanted to go, with a fantastic sense and pride in history, and I loved it. I love all the little traditions. I love you get a tie when you join the club, you get a tie for the 20th game, you get a tie for the 100th game, you get a tie for like 200th game, whatever it was. When you see a guy, an old dude walking with that special tie, you're like, ooh, shit, he's badass. You know, it's like a badge saying, no, don't mess with that one. Do not touch that one. He's like a vet but of Leicester, if you know what I mean. And I loved Welford Road. I'm still like, I've got goosebumps just thinking about it. It is a tremendously good stadium that fits with everything I like about rugby. The roughness, but the class, the roar, they like the physical side, the scrummaging and all that. And at the time, we had a hell of a team. and it's all down to that. Huh? 2 years, four finals. So, you know, it was pretty decent. Now, absolutely loved it.
Yeah, you mentioned before as well, Benjamin, sort of your upbringing, that you know, you lived in the States for a bit, you were over in Hong Kong. So did the move to England kind of not necessarily shock you the way it might shock other people moving to a different country, because you were experienced so many different cultures before?
Yeah, well, it's mainly the language barrier, to be fair. But it's also the fact that because I was born in Paris, raised in Paris and stuff, I'm a city boy. And the idea of moving to Clermont or Biarritz at the time, I remember even through the age groups, I was the only guy from Paris. Rugby in France, not anymore with racing and stade and stuff, but used to be very much Southwest based. Toulouse is like the capital of rugby, if you know what I mean. And I didn't know much about them because I traveled a lot when I was young because I say I'm from Paris, but I think by the age, from the age of 10 to 18, I think I calculated, 10 to 18, so 8 years, I did 9 schools. Because I used to change like almost once a year, and 1 year I did 2. And so, yes, I am from Paris. I was born and raised in Paris, okay. But when I say raised, I physically lived in Paris like 5 or 6 years in my life, up to when I was 18 and came back. So I didn't know much, and 4 of those years were not even in France. So I don't know much about Southwest. I don't know anything. So you know that cultural identity, I really struggle with, because it was a question that I didn't like to answer. Where are you from? I struggle with that. Because I would say Paris, but they would ask me, oh, do you know this place? And I was pretending. And, you know, that was a tough one for me. And that's why I fell in love with the proud of the region of Leicester. That's why I fell in love with the regional importance that Clermont, that Auvergne has in the club of Clermont. I want people to know, to be proud of what they're doing. And like I always say this, you jump into a cab in London or Paris, they're complaining about the weather, they're complaining about the traffic. You go in Clermont, they will tell you, not only they will greet you and your family the same, and then they will say, oh, sorry about the fact that we're a bit remote, but listen, we've got this mountain and I've got this restaurant. So they praise, they see the glass half full, if you know what I mean. They praise the good stuff rather than complaining about the bad stuff. And so it wasn't So for me, moving to Leicester was the same as moving to Clermont-Biarritz. It was something different, no language barrier. And I was very excited about the challenge and the fact that at the time, like I said, I was big, solid and stuff, but I wasn't the toughest hookers that was there. And that really, really pissed me off when they would say, oh, he's really good, but is he really tough? So I thought, listen, I'm just going to throw myself in the deep end. You know, the lion was waiting for me, or the tiger was waiting for me with his face right open. And I'm just going to dive in there and then see where I go.
Yeah, and you mentioned that sort of connection aspect there with Leicester and Leicester the place, Benjamin, and you talk as well there about Clermont as well. So I guess that's probably one of the main reasons, if not the main reason why you spent such a long period of your time in your career there.
In Clermont, yeah, I loved it. Fell in love with the place. My wife is English, and we were in Leicester. I was already in contact with Clermont, and I said to her, listen, I'm the French one, so France, I will tell you, we will never live there, ever. Because I was an idiot, and I actually never went to visit. I only went for rugby. So all you see is a crap hotel on the motorway. You remember the bus ride. And the back, it's funny because the back of the stadium is very, very ugly. There's a couple of streets there that are very ugly. If you go there in December, it's minus 20, you know, so you paint the whole picture. It's like, I don't really like that. Glasgow. I've never visited Glasgow. But every time I go, I'm like, bloody hell, the place. But actually, there's a lot more to it, you know, or Edinburgh, or Scotland in general. If you go in December, you know, all you see is the bad stuff. But actually, there's a lot more to it. And so basically, I told her that we would never go. And then we end up visiting once. And I actually really liked the place. And then it was a time in my career where I needed that bit of confidence boost, a bit of a mental thing. And Vern Cotter was instrumental in that. When my career was going like this, but his idea of me was staying the same. And instead of being the coach that said, you know, you need to win my support and confidence every week, he's like, you are going to be the starting hooker for my team for the next 4 years. Don't cock it up. And that's the first time that ever happened to me. And then I killed it that season. I killed it. I had one of the best seasons of my career, the first one. Then playing with the French team was tough because I was a bit more like this, just because of fitness-wise, it was really tough. And then I really enjoyed the end of my career. But no, Clermont was huge. It was the best rugby years of my career and also the most rewarding human-wise, because at the end, post-2015 World Cup, when I've got no more French team, I've got my businesses on the side, I'm a father, I've got two little girls and this and that, and I loved it. So I started every game. I think in 10 years at Clermont, we played, 11 finals or something. Maybe not 11 finals. I think to 10 years, probably played 8 finals. There's 3 seasons where we do both. So, I mean, every year we were playing a minimum of a semi and a semi, you know? So I made so many memories of extraordinary games. We beat Munster and Munster. We beat Leinster and Leinster. We beat Saracens and Saracens multiple times. Did 3 Champions Cup finals with them, 3 top 14 final, 1 Challenge Cup final. You guys, there was so much to it. So loved it, adored it, gave absolutely everything that I had in the tank for this team and for those fans, because they were just extraordinary. Again, different podcast. I think you can just say, let's talk about the Yellow Army, because you can go for days about them. They're just legendary. Loved every second, but you got to move on. You got to do other things.
Yeah, you mentioned the finals as well there, Benjamin. And I think a lot of people in the media are very quick to say that, oh, let's feel sorry for Clermont. Let's call them the bridesmaids, if you like, the nearly men, because you got so many finals and maybe didn't get to that final hurdle. But I know you said, I think it was before the top 14 final last year, that you were quite frustrated by that phrase, because a lot of the players in that squad were big game players, weren't they? So they knew what it was to take to get to these finals and win them.
Yeah, and what really frustrated me is that some players believe what the press say. And some players would actually almost ask for people to feel sorry for them. If you take every single final, there's one final in my whole career that I've got here, because that's the god of rugby that didn't want to give it to me, is the Toulon final in Champions Cup in Dublin 2013. We lose by 1 point. You know, the try celebration of Dylan Armitage, who goes like this to Brock James, that one. We played so well that game. We played so well. There's one try that should have not been allowed. And then there's 20 minutes with not one penalty. We missed 2 drop goals and we lose by 1 point. You know, I'm thinking, this one we had. This one is this one was for us. This one is the god of rugby didn't want to reward us. every single other one, we weren't good enough. That's all there was to it. There's nothing to do with bridesmaids or whatever. We were good enough to get to the final. But in 2015, we get bullied by Toulon in Champions Cup. In 2017, Saracens should have put 40 points on us. And because we're a very good team and we stuck strong and we stuck tight together and we've got balls of steel, we only lose by 5 points. But I've watched that game loads of times. We should have lost by 40. We were beaten by better. That's it. And all those other defeats, they always have a reason to it. So it pisses me off because it makes us, I don't know how you say it in faire des pleurs, like crying babies, which is not the way that those Monday video sessions were ran. I'm telling you, there was never a moment, you can trust Vern Cotter with that, to try to say, oh, let's feel sorry for ourselves. It's not your fault, boys. It's luck. It's the gods didn't want to give it to you. Nah, I'm telling you that it was not the way that these things were handled. So that's the only thing that annoys me. But other than that, life happens. And to be fair to the Clermont fans, that's why I tell you why they're so good. They celebrate with wins, not once in the world, or maybe once or twice, because there's idiots everywhere. But I told them straight away, would overstep a little bit, and say, why didn't you do this, whatever. Huh? And that's it. But I lived right in the center of Clermont. I live 400 meters from the Place d'Aujaud, which is like the main square. Never, ever, ever did anybody say anything. Or if they did, they would find me in front of their faces. But other than that, it was just stay out of your way. That's why they were so good.
You're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads podcast.